Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of Radio Grimbald from RadioGrimbald.com. I am your host, Goldine Ogawa, and welcome to the sixth episode of Radio Grimbald. It's the beginning of our second season, and it's good to be back. I know it's a bit late to wish you a conventional Happy New Year, so Happy Chinese New Year! By the time you're hearing this, it will be the Year of the Dragon. And for those interested, it's the Year of the Water Dragon, which I think is pretty cool. Anyway, for those of you just joining the program, I am Goldine Ogawa, and I'm a writer of sorts, and this is where you can find me reading my stories. This season, I'm going to be reading a series of short stories that I wrote over the past 5 years or so. They are all set in the same world, and they center on the adventures of a very particular magician named Bo Ragnar Phelps. Bo Ragnar Phelps is, well, I think I should just let you listen to the story and decide that for yourself. But before we begin, I would like to take the time to mention the three men who had the biggest impact on the creation of the character and the stories he resides in. First, to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the grandfather of modern detective romance, for reasons which shall become obvious. Second, to the late Mr. Jeremy Brett, who breathed color and life and inflection into the character of Sherlock Holmes. If you are tempted to draw a comparison between the titular character of this story and that illustrious character, let it be known that he was not inspired so much by the original literary incarnation of Sherlock Holmes, but more so by Jeremy Brett's vivid portrayal. And finally, to Mr. Christopher Chant, the current crestomancy in the novels by Diana Wynne Jones, owner of many colorful dressing gowns and the model for all the best magic in these stories. I would like to thank them all very much. However, as two of them are dead and one is fictional, this dedication will have to do. Oh, and one last thing. I am indubitably Californian. And not having the benefit of a voice coach, I fear my accents in these stories will be somewhat, impressionistic, to put it politely. To residents of Britain, on which the country of Ireland is modeled, I can only say that, though it bears many superficial similarities to your great nation, Ireland is in fact a different place, and any, inconsistencies in my pronunciation may be put down to the fact that Irish accents are subtly different from British ones. So, thank you, and sorry. Note for the reader. The story that follows is set in a world rather like our own, in a time not far off from our late 19th century. However, there are two crucial differences. First, that magic is quite real in this world, and as a result there are a myriad of other, smaller differences that will become apparent as the story progresses. Second, it has its own calendar, and while I have changed the names of the months and the days of the week to correspond with our own, I have left the numbering of the years alone. This could cause some confusion, since their calendar is somewhat older than our commonly used Gregorian calendar, and thus can give the impression that this story takes place in the future. But this is only because their calendar, called by its creators the Cordian calendar, has had a head start of about 400 years. For readers who are comfortable navigating their way through fantasy worlds, this one should be fairly straightforward. For novice travellers, know this. The world you are entering is completely separate from our own, with its own unique history, geography, religions, and politics. However, enough parallels may be drawn between it and ours that, without any more explaining on my part, you should be able to get along just fine. G.O. The Purple Gentleman. Copyright 2011 by Goldine Ogawa.
When I stepped off the train at Redling City Central one morning in early March, so many, many years ago, I was a girl of 14 with little confidence, a troubled upbringing, a prim disposition, and not a single relation to my credit. My parents had died suddenly in an accident aboard the steamship Candiza, an accident I avoided only by chance. I had caught fever and been unable to come on the voyage. This catastrophe left me in a fragile emotional state and utterly alone. Though there were sympathetic friends more than willing to take in the lonely Birch orphan, this would not come to pass. For my parents' will had stated quite clearly that should anything happen to them, my care would be entrusted to that of my godfather, a certain Mr. Beauragner Phelps. Mr. Phelps had been my father's benefactor in his youth, but they had had a falling out some time after the will was made, and it had never been updated with a more suitable guardian. However, once Mr. Phelps had been contacted, and it took some time, he agreed to take me in, to everyone's horror, thus ruining all attempts by my former well-meaning neighbours to provide me with any kind of comfort. So there I was, a lonely, somewhat tear-stained young girl in old tweed travel attire, adrift in the sea of movement that was Redling City Station. The note I clutched in my hand stated that I was to look for a tall gentleman with dark hair when I arrived in the city. I looked about energetically for someone who matched this description, and although I located several tall, dark-haired men, none of them looked at all pleasant. I could not bring myself to speak to them. I had a strange hope that Mr. Phelps would recognize me and thus save me this trouble. But why should he? I had never met him in my life, and I had no reason to expect that he should know what I looked like. It was a nerve-wracking position, alone in a crowded station, in a strange city, looking for a man I did not know, made even more distressing by my recent history and the fresh emotional wounds of my parents' passing. After about 10 minutes of futile searching, I began to cry, much to my embarrassment. I was a proud girl and felt it weakness of character to show such emotion in a public place. I located a small waiting bench in an out-of-the-way corner near the entrance, and lugging all my suitcases over to it, I sat down and busied myself with a handkerchief. I had to stay busy for some time, as at any point when I felt that my tears began to dry, I would reconsider my situation, and they would begin again. It all seemed rather dreadful and hopeless to me. I had about 15 shillings in my purse, enough for a small meal and a cab fare if necessary, but not enough to get on with in the great city of Redling. I was stranded, alone, and in a terrible state of mind, when a young boy detached himself from the writhing crowd and came over to me. I thought at first that he was a street urchin like I had read about in my books, and drew back from him, he was so covered in dirt and grime. In age he appeared to be about 10, with a torn and frayed jacket and a grease smudge across his right cheek. His hair was an unruly mop of silver strands, which impressed me. It was silver, sparkling silver, as if metallic threads had been sewn in amongst the luminous white hair. He looked straight at me, for he was short and I was seated, with deep brown eyes that seemed to hold more seriousness than one would expect from so young a child. "Hello," he said seriously. "Hello," I said, wondering what he could be wanting. "A handout, perhaps?"
"You wouldn't happen to be Miss Corianne Birch, would you?" he asked.
"Why, yes, that is me," I exclaimed, suddenly filled with hope that someone had come to my rescue.
"I thought so," the boy said, and smiled, showing teeth in rather a questionable condition. "My name is Abharis. Mr. Beauragner Phelps asked me to come and pick you up, as he had a slight problem that is detaining him."
He said this last part with a twinkle in his eye, suggesting that this slight problem was of a humorous nature. I nodded, and reaching out a grubby hand, he took the larger of my bags and began hauling it towards the entrance with little effort, though it was more than half his size. I followed, carrying my other bag and almost trotting to keep up. It made me wonder at the energy of the child. Once we were out of the station, he hailed a cab in the most heart-stopping manner I have ever seen.
When the first few paid no heed to the shabby and underage fare, he threw himself bodily in front of the next one, causing the horse to start and throw his head up, much annoying the driver. While he was berating the young Abharis, I tactfully shoved my bags up and hopped inside, flashing my silver coins at the cabbie when he turned to object. Abharis joined me, and an instant later we were jostling through the crowded streets of central Redling on our way to my new home. The cab was damp and drab, and Abharis proved reticent when it came to polite conversation. Combined with my own nerves, this rendered the trip a rather uncomfortable one. Fortunately, it being a brilliant spring day, the outside world provided plenty of distractions. The streets were busy and bustling, and the noise such that it easily penetrated the cab. I looked out once to see that we were passing through the theatre district, and then uptown towards Widdershinfield, where most of the aristocracy lived. It occurred to me, with no small lurch of nerves, that Mr. Phelps might be higher up in the world than I had been led to believe. But before my imagination could stretch the possibilities over far, we made a sharp turn down a side street and came to a clattering halt outside a perfectly unremarkable red brick house set in so close among the other identical houses that no space was left between. Upon setting my feet on the sidewalk, I noted that many of the houses on either side of the street had curtains of vivacious ivy draped down the front, and the one we faced was so covered many of the lower windows looked in danger of losing their usefulness. While I observed our new surroundings, Abharis liberated my luggage and dismissed the cabbie. Taking the larger of the two bags, he abruptly thrust the other at me with a sharp, "Hold this!" I took it, feeling a little affronted. The boy marched up to the door and rang the bell. It was now, as my eyes idly slid over what I assumed to be my new home, that I noticed what would be the first of many oddities of the day. The address had no number. The houses on either side had neat little plates with numbers like 7025, 7027, or, across the street, 7024, 7028, and so on. But the brass plaque next to the door of the house before me simply read, B. Phelps, number 0000. The queerness of this was a little unnerving, and I had a mind to ask Abharis for an explanation there and then, but at that moment the door opened and he ushered me inside. There was a large, extremely healthy plant in the hall, almost as vivacious as the ivy outside. The walls were papered in ash rose, with deep crimson carpets on the floor. Elegantly framed pictures hung at intervals along the wall, and here and there dark green draperies hung, apparently for no other reason than aesthetic decorum. The hall was tiled in severe black and white checker, which led to a stair on one side and an open dark doorway on the other. "The pantry's down there," Abharis informed me as we made our way laboriously up the steps. My trunk seemed to be getting heavier every moment.
"You'll be lodging on the first floor with Mr. Phelps."
Even he was gasping for breath now.
"Mrs. Bryce, the housekeeper, she's on the second, and Mrs. Dwana lives above her."
He paused on the landing to turn and face me.
"Don't bother Mrs. Dwana," he said, deeply serious, and continued up the stairs, myself struggling behind.
On the next landing, a hall branched off, and this we took, thankfully. Somewhere nearby, a grandfather clock intoned 12 noon, and almost at the same time, the air was pierced by the most mournful, unearthly wail I had ever had the displeasure of hearing. I stopped in my tracks, but Abharis, who was ahead of me, continued on as if this were perfectly ordinary, and after a few seconds, the sound died away. The hall ended in a door, with one door to right and left. Abharis planted my bag outside the right-hand door, which was flanked by two particularly sinister-looking portraits, and stretched comfortably. I deposited my own burden beside him and waited, attempting to look calm and demure and not breathe too hard.
"This will be your room," Abharis said, jerking a thumb toward the door. "It used to be Mr. Phelps' second study, his storeroom, really. I gave it a good cleaning, but there might be some fairy dust left in the corners."
I nodded and smiled as if this were perfectly understandable. Abharis looked gratified and slightly relieved.
"His room is upstairs," he continued, pointing down the hall to the stairwell. "So is the washroom.
Sitting room is across from you, and that, he pointed at the door right at the end, is his main study. He turned to look at me with somber, deep brown eyes. Don't go in there. I nodded again, feeling some of my nerves returning, but the next second Abhara smiled radiantly and ran a hand through his silver locks. Right then, he said. Time to introduce you. At that moment, another wail rent the air, this time rising into a shriek that left my ears ringing. Abhara seemed to notice it this time. He frowned.
I thought he'd have finished with her by now, he said, rubbing his chin. Ah, well, it should teach him to schedule his appointments better. He knew you were coming and everything. Come on.
Taking me firmly by one elbow, he led me across the hall and flung open the door.
Mr. Boragner Phelps, he said,
sounding considerably more imperious than a person of only 10 or so should be allowed.
May I introduce your new ward? Miss Corianne Birch.
I stepped up behind him as he spoke, but stopped dead as soon as I entered the room. It was quite possibly the most bizarre scene that had ever met my eyes. The room itself was ordinary and pleasant enough. 3 rows of long windows let in plenty of daylight, giving it a glowing, bright feel. It was furnished mainly in maroon and ash rose, like the hall, with a comfortable sofa and a set of armchairs. There was a writing desk, full to overflowing with papers, old teacups, and other less conventional items. A human skull with horns, a pair of antlers, an empty vase, and a tiny, indescribable hat. The mantelpiece above the fireplace was similarly overstocked, and even the floor was not exempt from the litter. I had nearly stepped on a beautifully carved wooden flute on my way in. About the only thing clear and tidy was the tea table, which was set for 2 and obviously in use. It was to this that my attention was first drawn. There was a man sitting at the table, for all appearances perfectly relaxed and contented. He was of middle age, slender and long-limbed, with smooth dark hair and elegant white hands. He had an impressive aquiline nose, a narrow face with a high forehead, and was dressed immaculately in a dark purple frock coat with a cherry-coloured waistcoat and matching cravat. He sat with his fingertips together, oblivious to our arrival, staring attentively at the figure who was sprawled, still moaning quietly, upon the floor. This was a handsome, middle-aged woman. She seemed to have swooned, conveniently missing a nearby armchair and several brass figurines scattered about the floor. She was dressed in a blue travelling outfit, with her greying blonde hair piled haphazardly on top of her head, and the crumpled remains of a letter clutched in one hand. As I watched in shock and fascination, she stirred, her free hand coming up to steady her hair, which looked ready to escape and swarm wildly about the floor. Propping herself up on her elbows, she stared first at Abhorus, who was closer, and then at me, with some apprehension. Her eyes were wide and frightened, and her unhealthy graying skin flushed with pink around her cheeks. She made an inarticulate noise somewhere between a moan and a yelp, and this at last roused the purple-clad gentleman, whom I could only assume was Mr. Boragner Phelps, from his reverie. He looked up at the two of us sharply with pale brown eyes that stood out under strong dark brows, a crease of annoyance running down one side of his face, and his mouth twisted into a distinctly disapproving shape.
"Dear Abhorus," he said, "this is most inconvenient."
"Miss Corianne Birch, sir,"
Abhorus repeated with admirable patience. I tried to put on my most demure and attentive look, but felt that I failed miserably, possibly because Phelps's reaction to my introduction was to wave a long hand dismissively.
"No, no, no," said he. "I'm afraid she won't do, Abhorus. Better put her in the closet until we're finished here."
And so it happened that I had not been in my new home 5 minutes before, to my great consternation, I was bundled aside and shoved briskly into a stuffy, dark closet. As closets go, it was a fairly large, roomy one, not being overstuffed nor smelling too strongly of mothballs. Even so, it became significantly less than comfortable within only a few minutes, and a little after that, dreadfully boring and tedious.
I could only catch one or two out of every five words that were spoken by the people outside, so following the conversation was frustrating business. The words trap and insidious and enigma cropped up fairly often, but I was unable to discern the story behind them. Finally, after what must have been at least 30 minutes of exasperating tedium, there was a brisk movement on the other side of the door, and the faint but unmistakable sound of chairs being pushed back. Only then did I give in to temptation to eavesdrop, and pressed my ear hopefully to the wood in order to catch any vocal confirmation that the interview was coming to a close.
"I can only express to you my deepest sympathies for your loss," Phelps was saying, "and add that it is of the utmost importance that you follow these instructions to the letter."
There was a snivel of compliance in response.
"Sir!"
Abharis began, but was cut off.
"Now, I don't expect to see you again until at least 10:30 tonight, and I am afraid that will leave you exposed for an undesirable amount of time."
"Of course.
Abharis shall accompany you."
"Sir!"
"Thank you very much. It is too good of you."
"Sir!"
"Will you desist, Abharis? I need you to accompany Lady Knighton tonight."
"Sir!"
Abharis said, with real vehemence this time.
"About the matter of the lady in your closet."
"Now really, Abharis, how many times have I told you that closets are no place for ladies?"
"It has not yet occurred even once, sir. But it was you what put her there, and I don't think she's too happy about it."
"Well, naturally she is not. It is only what one can expect. Would you let her out and see she is properly refreshed?"
"I'm afraid not, sir,"
Abharis said, and there was no mistaking the satisfaction in his voice.
"I must accompany Lady Knighton. You will have to see to her settling in. She's your ward, after all."
There was the patter and clomp of two pairs of feet exiting the room and the smart clap of the door being closed. Phelps gave an exasperated sigh.
"Well, come out," he said. "The door isn't locked, you know."
After some nervous fumbling in the dark, I located the latch and let myself back out into the world of light. While I adjusted to the sudden shift in environment, Phelps's tall, lean figure dashed about the sitting room collecting apparently random artifacts off the carpet and throwing them haphazardly into a Gladstone bag that stood open on the tea table.
I ducked as a golden fountain pen came whizzing through the air near my head and fairly jumped out of my skin as a flapping book with silver bindings followed soon after. "Excuse me, sir," I began, hoping to impress my predicament upon my eccentric host.
"Never a moment, never a moment," he cried,
leaping over the sofa and flinging the doors open to the closet I had just vacated.
"If I may, sir,"
I tried again.
"I'll please you to desist, my dear,"
he said, somewhat muffled with his head inside the closet. While I was fuming at this blatant over-familiarity, he re-emerged, carrying a tartan scarf in one hand and a somewhat dented purple bowler in the other. Tossing the scarf carelessly over one shoulder, he examined the hat, which was truly in a sorry state, muttering something along the lines of, "Never should have let Abharis unpack." And then, quite suddenly, it was not dented anymore. While I was blinking at this impossibility, he handed me the scarf and swept off to the other side of the room to scan the bookshelf.
"I have known the tide to wait for a wizard," he said,
plucking a dishevelled volume off the shelf and tossing it into the bag as well.
"But curses are another matter."
"Curses?"
I said incredulously.
"Indeed."
His head whipped around to look at me as if he had not noticed my presence before. Pausing with one leg extended halfway over a footstool, he was quite a comical sight, although it was somewhat lost on me.
"Oh, this is most inconvenient," he said gravely, snatching the scarf out of my hands and disappearing into the hall.
He returned 2 minutes later, wearing a long lavender overcoat and a peaked hunting cap and carrying an extraordinarily long walking stick. He jabbed this in my direction and said distractedly,
"There's nothing for it. You'll have to come."
"Come?"
I said, exerting a supreme effort not to cry out at this maltreatment.
"It grieves me more than I can say," Phelps declared. "But Una was quite firm about it. She wants to be left in peace."
I wondered absently if Una was Mrs. Dwana, in which case I assumed Abharis's warning must have been genuine, But Phelps had swept on now, gathering his Gladstone under one arm and hooking his walking stick over his elbow.
Corian, wasn't it? Phelps asked.
Miss Corian Birch, I said, with as much disdain as propriety allowed. Phelps looked amused.
Very well, dear Corian. Then step this way, if you please. I fear we cannot afford any more time spent gazing in horror upon one another, for there is not an instant to lose.
So saying, he took me by my elbow, and we hurried out of the room and back down the stairs before I had time or presence of mind to protest. There was a four-wheeler waiting at the door, which Phelps bundled us into so fast I could only glimpse the colour of the horse, which was a dirty white.
"Max End, Geddon, and quickly!"
Phelps called up to the driver, and with a lurch and a rattle, we were off. At first, all I could do was stare stonily at the blank, black side wall of the carriage and try to stop my mind spinning. I was aware of Phelps withdrawing discreetly into a dark corner and rummaging through the contents of his bag, but restrained myself from taking an interest. I was still feeling slighted, almost offended at my treatment, but as the minutes dragged by and nothing of even trivial interest presented itself to disrupt the boredom of the ride, I began to have second thoughts. True, it was hardly proper treatment for a young lady, but underneath my prudish feelings I had to admit there was some element of excitement in getting whisked off on an adventure in such a way. But then, my rational side reasoned, there probably wouldn't be anything particularly interesting for me in it. Oh, the adults would no doubt find it fascinating, but I was likely to be bored out of my mind long before it was time to return home.
I don't think you will be so disappointed in this evening's events, Phelps remarked casually, closing his bag with a snap.
I beg your pardon, I said, suppressing a shiver. I was certain I had not spoken aloud, and here he had appeared to read my thoughts exactly.
You fear that all that awaits you at our destination is tedious boredom,
Phelps said, leaning back in his seat and crossing his long legs.
But I can assure you that I have no doubt you will find my task tonight as interesting as I do, perhaps more interesting than is usually comfortable.
I was a little perturbed by this. Do you read minds, sir? I asked, as politely as I could. Phelps's languid eyes seemed to focus and brighten in the gloom, although his face remained tranquil and relaxed.
"You flatter me, dear Corian," said he, with a smile. "I am no psychic. I merely read emotions. You can tell a lot of what a person is thinking by what they are feeling."
"Surely you're joking," I said.
"I never joke about my abilities."
"But that is quite preposterous." Phelps shrugged expressively.
"It is easy to see that you were offended by our abrupt departure, that you felt a slight spark of excitement followed by a hasty covering of cynicism that accompanies the reining in of unlikely hopes. From this, it is simple to realize that you had hoped our little venture might give you some entertainment, but quickly squashed the notion so as not to be disappointed, which, as I have said before, you will not be."
But how do you read emotions at all?" I exclaimed with some impatience. Boragner Phelps smiled lazily and retreated back into the shadows.
"It is a skill you develop over time, like learning to recognize notes in music."
And I was unable to extract another word out of him for the remainder of the journey. After another 20 minutes, we arrived at our destination. It was a huge, empty house, so old it must have been a country estate at one time, but had long since been consumed by the sprawling city. Up and down the street its younger, smaller neighbours looked slipshod and pretentious next to this old, crumbling piece of grandeur. The cab stopped, and we disembarked, Phelps handing the driver half a crown and asking him to wait around the corner. He unlatched the gate and held it open for me with a flourish before following me into the garden. The place was quite overgrown, and many of the trees had a bent or twisted look, as if they were blown by some otherworldly wind, and the once neatly clipped lawn had long since grown into a waving, grassy jungle, spilling over into the gravel path. Overall, the place gave a general feeling of malevolence that was quite disturbing, and I had the uncomfortable idea that someone, or several someones, were watching us from the long, swaying grass. Phelps seemed quite immune. He sauntered past me up the path as if it led to his summer home, the brisk crunching sound of his step in sharp contrast to the forbidding decay. Upon reaching the door, he rapped smartly on it 3 times, and to my astonishment and horror, it swung open of its own accord. Only a dark and dusty hall lay beyond, from which a strong smell of mildew rolled out, and again, the feeling of being watched.
"Welcome to Rammendorf Place," Phelps said pleasantly. "Better known to the world now as Max End."
As we entered, I thought I heard the sound of a bell tolling in the distance. It was faint and ghostly and seemed to resound inside my own head. The floorboards were covered in dust and groaned reproachfully when trod on. I stopped inside the door as Phelps swept past me into the gloom, heedless of the protesting floor, his lavender coat standing out brilliantly against the musty greys, greens and browns.
"Come along, dear Corianne,"
he said, extending his gloved hand. I took it, feeling somewhat childish, but nonetheless grateful to have something to hold on to. The empty, invisible watching feeling that filled the house bored into the back of my skull and made my neck crawl. The entire place was dark, but by no means empty. I could glimpse the vague outlines of high-backed chairs, sofas, coffee tables, and light stands. On the floor, rich brocade carpets covered almost every inch, and on the wall, magnificent portraits hung in gilt frames. While Phelps paused to examine a door that did not open for him, I peered earnestly into the gloom, trying to get a better look at the portraits. And with a sudden jolt, I realized that every single one of them was missing its eyes. When I pointed this out to Phelps, in a voice somewhat shriller than was normal for me, he chuckled softly.
"Their eyes are elsewhere," he said. "Watching."
"Watching for what?"
"Not us, thankfully. Now come."
Through the door we went, and up a flight of stairs, at last entering into a grand bedchamber hung with dusty tapestries. Once a great window must have let in the light, but now it was boarded up, leaving the room in perpetual gloom. Peering through the shadows, I perceived that much of the furniture, with the exception of the grand four-poster bed, was either broken or tipped on its side, as if someone had been through the room in a terrible rage. The bed, while intact, was unmade, as if the last person to sleep there had spent the night thrashing and kicking. Its once fine curtains were torn, and one of its posts had been broken down. The whole room had an eerie, brooding feel. But here at last the feeling of being watched vanished, and this offered me some comfort.
"Do not touch anything," Phelps whispered in my ear, "and make as little noise as possible."
So saying, he led me through the room, weaving in and out among the tumbled furniture, until we came to a giant wardrobe that stood hidden in the farther shadows. This was relatively intact, although the mirror that had once decorated the outside door had been smashed, and there were 3 clear, bloody handprints pressed into the wood. Phelps gently opened the door, revealing an empty, musty interior, with dust mice in the corners. Placing a hand on my back, he propelled me inside with him, swiftly shutting the door so it was only open a crack. Then he did something that made the air around me twinge, and for a moment everything looked rather distorted, as if the world were being pulled in 2 separate ways, before it snapped back into position again.
"We can talk now," Phelps said in his usual penetrating voice.
"Well, thank God for that," I exclaimed. "What is this place anyway?"
"One of the more unfortunate in Redling," Phelps said, taking a seat on the hardwood floor. He gestured to me to do the same. "The wait will be a rather long one, I fear, and better not to spend it on your feet."
I felt rather indignant at this, for my travelling outfit was not one that allowed me to sit very easily upon the floor, and Phelps made no move to help me as I struggled to arrange myself in a comfortable position. "If you'll pardon my asking," I said, somewhat tightly, "just what do you intend to do here, anyway?" Phelps raised his head, almost invisible in the dark, and I saw his shadow shrug.
With luck, I may be able to stop a great evil being done.
What sort of evil? I asked. I realized as I spoke that I was acting quite out of turn, but by this point I was so exasperated with Phelps's behavior that I felt I deserved at least some sort of enlightenment. Phelps sighed, and there were sounds of him leaning back against the wall of the wardrobe.
Well, I suppose we do have some time on our hands, said he. So I might as well give you a full explanation. Roughly 150 years ago, he began, there lived in this house a man named Gabriel Mack. He was a rich, well-to-do enchanter and a highly respected figure. But despite this, he was also power-hungry and ambitious. And although he possessed a great deal of wit and cleverness, he had almost no judgment to back it up. He had married one of his children into the peerage, and thence, through sheer tenacity, managed to push himself up the social ladder. It was then that he became acquainted with a certain Lord Bernack, a wealthy baron from Enwall. It is said that Mark fell in love with his wife, Lady Bernack, and through devious enchantments convinced her to run away with him. In his fury, Lord Bernack exposed him to society for what he was, a lowly mage. Since, as you may recall, magic users were shunned in high circles back then, this had the most unfortunate effect on Mac's reputation. Ruined and in shame, he fled society and lived as a hermit for years in Torland. When Bernack eventually caught up with him, he came back to Redling, to this very house, in fact. It was here that Bernack cornered him, in this very room. My records differ as to what happened next. Some say that Bernack simply killed Mac and was done with it. That is the story most widely accepted, at any rate. But there is another story, handed down through Bennock's descendants, that with his dying breath Mac put a curse on their family. Bad luck and ill fortune would follow them wherever they went, and he tied his life to their line, so his spirit would never rest until he had destroyed them completely. That is the reason we find ourselves waiting in such a dark and stuffy situation at the moment. Lady Knighton, whom I believe you saw briefly in my sitting room, is the last living descendant of Lord Bennock and the last flame in the line that the spirit of Gabriel Mack has set himself to extinguish. Already she has lost her parents, her husband and sister, and now I believe Mack is close to drawing his lethal net around her as well.
The darkness in the closet seemed to deepen as Boragner Phelps finished his chilling narrative, in light of which I found the disarray out in the room, the paintings without eyes, and the bedding torn to shreds take on a much more sinister meaning. "But you're going to stop it, aren't you?" I asked, finding my voice less steady than I expected.
"I can but try," Phelps said, knitting his long fingers together around his knees. "The curse was well woven, and has taken just about all my patience to untangle. Of course, Lady Knighton is not completely free of it, else we would not be here tonight. But I have high hopes that, unless we are extraordinarily unlucky, the whole matter will be finished and sealed long before the sun rises again."
"What do you intend to do?" I asked. "I have heard that curses cast upon death are extremely potent."
"You have heard correctly," Phelps said. "As to what I intend to do, that will depend entirely on forces beyond my control."
"But how—"
"You certainly are an inquisitive one," he said, with a small smile.
He was about to say more, but at that moment a sudden chill rose in the air. It crept up my spine and settled just below my neck, like something on ice-cold cat feet. In the gloom I saw Boragner Phelps spring to his feet and press both long hands over the door, peering intently into the wood as if to see through to the other side.
"He has come early."
I saw Phelps turn to look at me.
"If you wish to stay behind, I can sympathize. And this place is the safest in the house."
A minute ago I would have agreed wholeheartedly, but suddenly I was filled with an unreasonable indignation at being left behind. Now the chill seemed only to heighten the thrill of excitement, and it occurred to me that a long wait in a dark cupboard was what I had particularly wanted to avoid on this outing. I shook my head. "You already left me in a closet once today, Mr. Phelps."
"A factual observation I cannot deny," said he. "But I'm afraid I must once again ask for your complete silence when we are out in the house, and on no condition may you leave my side."
"You have my word," said I.
"Then we are off."
The bedroom looked the same as before, but the chill feeling was remarkably stronger, and Phelps seemed to home in on it like a hound on a trail. Out into the hall and down the stairs we went, but following a different path than that which we had taken on the way in. Phelps went bounding down another hallway, this one lined with row upon row of portraits. I only caught a brief glimpse of them as we hurtled past, but I did observe that, as before, each one was missing its eyes, at least at first. Halfway down the hall I saw one, peeking out from the shadows under a man's brow. It was piercing and white, and stared uncannily out at us from the canvas. Two frames later there was another, and then the paintings returned to normal as they could be with two white, staring eyes in the sockets of each subject. I was about to point this out to Phelps, who was some ways ahead, but when I caught up I found him almost doubled over, his hands frantically working the air in front of his knees. Then I remembered his request for silence, and thought better of speaking. He stood up a moment later. We took a right turn that seemed to open up out of nowhere, and now the air was positively frigid. Hurrying down a dark passage, mercifully devoid of paintings, and therefore eyes, I could hardly hear the pounding of our feet for the great heaving breaths I was obliged to take. Then around a corner I saw a smudge of white. It disappeared, leaving a trail of shimmering coldness in its wake that made my heart turn over. I glimpsed it again at the end of the next hall, but now we slowed our pace, as if Phelps purposefully did not want to get too close to whatever was ahead of us. I couldn't say I disagreed, for whatever it was gave off such a strong sense of misfortune, I hardly wished to go near it. After three more turns and two more close encounters with the apparition, we were suddenly in a wide hall, facing a magnificent double door. Phelps approached cautiously and even more carefully nudged one side open with his toe. He beckoned me with a quick gesture, and I slipped through after him and found myself standing on the balcony of perhaps the most impressive ballroom I had ever seen. In size it was enormous, big enough to hold a respectable house and garden, with a beautiful marble dance floor, albeit dusty and drab from ages of disuse. The balcony we were on ran in a complete circle around the entire room, with three grand stairs that led down to the ground. Every inch of the available wall space was covered in portrait paintings. And here at last I found where all the eyes had gone to. They were all here, in the paintings. White, blank eyes stared out from every dark nook and cranny of the canvases. Faces held at least 3 to 5 pairs of them, and they popped up in elbows, hats, hands, gloves, and especially in the dark corners near the bottoms of the frames. While I stared around in horror, Phelps strode off along the balcony and leaned over the railing to peer into the gloom. When I did the same, all I could see was the empty dance floor, but as I scanned the area, I noticed a small figure crouched in one of the corners. As I watched, it moved, and was led by a much smaller shape out into the centre of the floor. They could not have been ghosts, for I could hear the patter of their feet across the marble, and as they came out of the shadows somewhat, I recognised them as Lady Knighton and Abharis. Phelps had dropped to his knees and was peering through the bars. When I glanced back a second later, he had gone, and I opened my mouth to let out a yell of alarm, but it died in my throat. Something white and cold and glowing had floated into the ballroom down below. I recognised it at once as the same apparition we had been following earlier, only now the chills were more intense, and it seemed as though the whole room had grown colder. It crept up my spine, down my arms, and I saw my breath rising as steam before me. Gripping the banister until my knuckles turned white and my hands went numb, I watched in fascinated horror as the glowing figure dove towards Lady Knighton and Abharis. I could see that she was shaking terribly, and there was something clenched tightly in her right hand. With a sound like a thousand voices distantly screaming, the apparition pounced on them, and in that moment I made perhaps the greatest blunder of that evening. I closed my eyes. I heard Abharis yell something, a tinkle of broken glass, and a real, full-bodied scream. Then I felt a blast of cold in my face, and I opened them to find the apparition charging right at me. It seemed dimmed somewhat and spattered with red. Its arms were outstretched and reaching for me with emaciated claw-like hands, and I glimpsed a hollow, screaming face nestled in amongst the wild mane of white hair. My legs failed me, and I fell to the ground in a most unladylike manner. Above me the creature let out a terrible scream and froze in mid-air. Phelps had reappeared, standing not 5 feet away with one hand spread open, almost like a gesture of welcome, but his face was dead serious and his hand itself was bright red with blood.
"That will be enough from you, Gabrion Mac," he said. "Your curse is broken."
With a terrible scream, the ghost left me and hurtled through the air towards him. But before it ever reached Phelps's hands, there was a sound like a whip crack, and a flash that was more felt than seen. And it was gone. I stared at the place where it had last been, terrified, relieved, and shocked all at once. I watched in stunned silence as Phelps took out his handkerchief and wiped the blood off his hands before binding around the place where the blood had come from, a small slit across his wrist. Despite this, he looked very pleased with himself and was even chuckling a little when he came over and helped me to my feet.
"Not singed at all?" he asked cheerfully.
I looked myself over, realizing for the first time that, although I had had the most terrible fright of my life, I was otherwise unharmed. "Not in the least," I said, my voice still rather unsteady. "Only a little shaken."
"Excellent, excellent. And how extraordinarily fortunate. You'll be back to your old self in 5 minutes, at the most. Now let us see how our other half fared."
Abharis was straining under the weight of Lady Knighton when we arrived, for she had swooned once again and was now weak and delirious. I was obliged to help the poor boy lead her out of the house while Phelps went ahead to hail the cab. The woman could only moan and whimper, although by the time we got her to the door, Abharis had managed, by some miracle, to bring her around somewhat. We stood in the brisk night air in the pool of light under a street lamp to wait for the cab. Mac's End was still as dark and gloomy as ever, but no longer carried such a sinister, threatening feel to it. I began, instead, to feel quite pleased with our little escapade, even though I had only a minimal part in it, and perhaps even less understanding of what had actually happened.
"Well, it didn't go exactly according to plan,"
Phelps admitted when I asked him.
"Curse lighting is always a tricky business, and you were an unforeseen factor. I was counting on a little blood being enough to weaken the curse, in effect, throwing off the entity so I could neutralize it. I couldn't let it sense me, however. That would have put it on the defensive, and we would have never seen it again. Thus I was obliged to put the good lady into some considerable danger for a short while. But the risk paid off."
"I see," I said, although I couldn't quite, yet. "How generous of you to go through so much trouble for her."
"Ah, not exactly," Phelps said, kicking at a small stone. "The solving of sinister magics and problems of an enchanting manner are, after all, my chosen occupation. I have taken the liberty of experimenting here somewhat, at the expense of Lady Knighton's nerves and your patience. You did very well, by the way."
"Did I?"
"Indeed. So much so I fear I may be tempted to take you along the next time one of these little problems presents itself. But that is a long way in the future, and here is our cab to take us to a closer one. We shall leave Abharis in the theatre district. We have demanded too much of him this day, and it is on our way. Deposit the good lady at her house, and then back to my old home and your new one, for I believe a good supper and a considerable amount of unpacking
await us. The End.
This is only the first in a series of stories told from the perspective of young Corianne Birch. This series can roughly be divided into two distinct volumes, the first of which will be covered in this season of Radio Grimbald. Bo Ragnar Phelps, and Abharis for that matter, are both characters that make repeat appearances in my stories. In addition to The Adventures of Bo Ragnar Phelps, they both appear in my webcomic Angel Devil, which can be read online at www.angeldevilmanga.com. You should be able to find a link to that in the blurb attached to this episode, and I would be absolutely chuffed if you went and had a look. Just keep in mind that it started in 2004, and as such there is a pretty severe incline in the quality of artwork. For anyone interested in reading more about Mr. Phelps, you can find this and many of his other adventures available as ebooks the world over in the Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble Nook, and iTunes iBook stores. You can also find the complete catalog of my work over on my own website at goldeneogawa.com/books. Again, links in the blurb. Look for them. Go to them. It would make me happy. All the ebooks have extra artwork that you won't find on the blog, so I highly recommend checking them out. That is all for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope the accents weren't too annoying. Next week, continuing with the adventures of Bo Ragnar Phelps, I'll be reading the second story, The Crimson Stair. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions about the podcast, or me, feel free to email me at goldeneogawa, that's goldeneogawa, at gmail.com. And you can tweet me. If you're on Twitter, you can follow me at GrimbyTweets. Now, before I go, I just have to say special thanks for their help in the production of Radio Grimbald go out to Marion Goldeen, my wonderful mother, Evan Ogawa, and Rachel Goldeen for creating the theme music, and of course to you for listening. Radio Grimbald is written, performed, edited, and just about everything else by me, Goldeen Ogawa. Find out more on the web at radiogrimbald.com and goldeneogawa.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, take care and have fun. Thank you.